For tedious technical reasons, we had to record this edition of You're Not On The List using Zoom. Unfortunately, that means the sound quality is slightly less than satisfactory throughout the episode, and we hope it doesn't spoil your enjoyment too much. Hello, I'm Jim Irvin. Welcome along to another You're Not On The List, the podcast devoted to forgotten albums and the people who love them. My first guest today is American singer-songwriter Michelle Branch, whose roots are an intriguing blend of Irish, French and Indonesian. She grew up in Arizona and recorded her debut album Broken Bracelet aged just 17. That led to a deal with Warner Offshoot Maverick Records and two hit albums Spirit Room and Hotel Paper, the latter making number two on the Billboard Hot 100. She won a Grammy in 2003 for her top five single with Carlos Santana, Game of Love. And in 2005, she formed country duo The Wreckers, and made a hit album pointedly titled Stand Still, Look Pretty. Shortly after that, she became a mother for the first time and then spent several years trying to break away from the direction expected of her, launching a parallel career as an online chef and food pundit. She left Warner Brothers in 2013 after they'd failed to release two albums in a row. In 2015, she met Patrick Carney of the Black Keys at a Grammy party, and they began making sweet music together, to wit, an album, Hopeless Romantic, released in 2017. And then two children, son Reese, released in 2018, and daughter Willie, who dropped last February. Coincidentally, my second guest is drummer and producer Patrick Carney, who grew up in Akron, Ohio, a close neighbour of Dan Auerbach, who became his colleague in the Black Keys, though they didn't actually meet until high school. A self-taught drummer, he bought his first kit with the proceeds of a dishwashing gig. The Black Keys' debut, The Big Come Up, was released in 2002, and 20 years on, their 11th album, Dropout Boogie, comes out on May the 13th. Now resident with his family in Nashville, Patrick has produced albums by the band Tennis and soloists Tobias Gesso Jr., Karen Elson, and Calvin Johnson. He also presents a regular radio show on US station Sirius called Sirius Boredom. Welcome, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me for this.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Especially as you have a two-month-old baby.
You might hear her in the background. So,
are you both in a strange zone right now, or is it all cool?
It's all cool.
I think we're pretty good. Honestly, our son, who's 3.5, has been the hardest adjustment. He's been dethroned, and he's not really sure how to take it.
Yeah. You're our first married couple and first guests in Nashville. How's the old place?
Oh, it's good.
Yeah, the city's changed so much since I moved here 12 years ago, and it's exploded. We kind of live outside of town. I don't go into town much, but every time I do go in, I'm kind of shocked at how much it's changed.
Yeah, it seems like there's a new skyscraper going up every time we go downtown. The skyline is just drastically changing. During lockdown, so many people fled, especially New York and L.A., if they were in the music business and other entertainment kind of businesses, everyone seemed to kind of immediately flock here.
Patrick, you've moved your studio down here, obviously. Do you get to use it much?
Yeah. Dad, I produced a record for this band called Bass Drum of Death that comes out on Fat Possum. I'm not sure if it's later this year. I think later this year or early next year. And then Michelle and I worked on a new record for her, which will be released via Nonesuch. So she's back on Warner Brothers. That's coming out in September. Ever since having kids, I kind of relish like time to spend with them. And then when I'm not spending time with them, I prefer to zone out.
Yes.
He prefers to golf. Let's be realistic. Golfing became one of his obsessions during the pandemic that he has now, it's grown into a love. I'm not only a tour widow now, I'm a golf widow also.
and you never played it before, Patrick. Was it the first time during lockdown?
I've spent 20 years taking part in maybe the most infuriating business you could take part in. So I switched to the most infuriating sport that you can take part in. Yeah.
And it just came naturally to you.
Yeah.
So, Michelle, you marked the 20th anniversary of your breakthrough album, The Spirit Room, last year. Was that fun or did it feel a bit weird?
It was both. So I'm a huge fan of Alanis Morissette. And when she hit the 10-year anniversary for Jagged Little Pill, she did an acoustic re-record of the album that I really treasured as a fan of hers, that kind of planted the seed of, you know, oh, one day it would be great to do that to the Spirit Room, especially because I was so young when I recorded it. Mm. And mostly just because I feel like my vocals have changed a lot. My voice just naturally isn't as high as it was on those recordings. So I really wanted to take a stab at doing something special for hardcore fans of that record and re-record it. And it was a fun project. Patrick did it with me here at home during lockdown. And the thing is, the original album took 3 weeks to record and the re-record took like 6 months. So it was really kind of not as easy of a project to do because I had major demoitis. I was just like wanting everything to sound like the record. And it was hard to, you know, take yourself out of that.
Yeah. I mean, in retrospect, do you think that being put on the sort of path to a pop career was the right thing for you? I mean, I assume it's what you wanted at the time, but was it the right kind of career path that you were given early on?
You know, I don't even know if I was put on a pop path. It just happened so fast. Right, I don't think anyone expected it to resonate the way it did. You know, I certainly was into kind of more of the singer-songwriter genre when I was signed and played guitar and wrote my music at a time when it was really rare for teen girls to be doing so. But, you know, it resonated and it definitely had a life that I think kind of surprised everybody initially. But sometimes I look back and think of things I would have done differently. And I definitely treasure it a lot more now than while I was in the thick of it. Mm.
Patrick, you're about to drop the 11th Black Keys album, Dropout Boogie. The last one, Delta Cream, you recorded in 10 hours. Is that right? I assume this one took a bit longer, did it?
The last record we made was all North Mississippi blues covers that we played with these other musicians. It was actually the first time that Dan and I've ever made a record live in the studio because, you know, it's just the two of us. We'd always be doing overdubs and things like that. So, yeah, it came out last year. It was up for a Grammy. It lost yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's all good. Very few records worth the shit I've ever given a Grammy. Maybe they're getting a Grammy. It certifies your records being trash, maybe, actually. But
I take offense to that. No, I'm kidding.
For me, like, so, you know, someone said, like, what's the best record ever made? Lately, I've been saying The Clash, London Calling, you know, and this is, The Clash never received any sort of accolade like that. You know, so many good records and never get recognized. So yeah. I'm happy.
Your Neil Young Grammy story is one of my favorites.
Yeah, well, that this is a quick little story, is that we got nominated for a Grammy for the first time on our sixth record. So we go to LA and we're standing there. Our award that we're up for is, you know, announced, and we win for like best rock performance or whatever. The next award is best rock song. And the winner is Neil Young, and this is his first Grammy Award. So I was like, shit, I've had a Grammy longer than Neil Young. I was like, so the two have won the Grammy, and then like instantly it was just completely devalued by the fact that one of my heroes had never, you know, it's a completely stupid fucking trophy.
Well, is it true that you met at a Grammy party, you and Michelle?
Well, I was going to say, we have that to think.
So yeah, that brings a certain frisson to it every year from now on, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I'd always take advantage of a trip to Los Angeles to go stay at like Chateau Marmont and like eat at Sushi Park. So that's what I did. I happily went to LA and sat in a corner drinking Greyhounds by myself. And then Michelle walked into the party that I was at and we hit it off, and we both were equally antisocial, and we fell in love.
You hit it off by ignoring each other, did you?
We hid in the corner.
We were ignoring the cocaine abuse happening throughout the rest of the
party we were at.
So tell us a bit about Dropout Boogie, Pat. What's it? Is it a departure? Is it more of the same? What kind of thing have you been doing on this?
I don't think of our records in terms of that kind of thing, really. Like, we're never striving to do something different just to do it.
Yeah.
When we're making something, the goal is just, are we enjoying what we're making, you know? And honestly, there's been times where that hasn't been the case fully, you know? Mm. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes it's been a struggle to maintain a creative output. That rarely, but a couple times that's been the case. I think like Let's Rock was a situation where it was us, you know, we hadn't made a record together in 5 years, and learning how to work together again was a bit of an adventure, but it resulted in us making a record that I'm proud of, Let's Rock. But what I'm more proud of from that process is we relearned how to work together and how to get along, and our relationship became better than ever. And this record, I think, was just a blast to make. We spent most of the summer last year at Dan's studio joking around and making this record. And I think it's one of our best. You know, I'm excited for people to hear it.
I agree with, I mean, I'm a little biased, but I love the record. I'm so into it.
Well, you would. It's all Michelle Branch covers. We haven't really given up that, but.
I read an interview with Daryl Hall the other day of Hall & Oates, and he said that being in a duo is really annoying. You're either answering questions about or being discussed in relation to the other one. Have you found that?
I don't mind answering questions about the band. It's like I've devoted my creative life to it. You know, the minute I saw Dan perform the first time, I knew I would be smart to hitch up to his talent and go along for the ride. You know, I do have something to offer him, and I like the partnership that we have a lot, and I really value it. And at one point I wasn't sure if we were going to make another record. It wasn't like we broke up or anything. There's no discussion, but we had gone through this very crazy trajectory from starting in Akron, Ohio, as just two neighborhood kids who hated college and liked the same music, and we started this band and we got a small record deal, and eventually we go from playing to like 10 people to headlining Coachella. We've gone from the bottom to the top, and I think once we got to the top it was a little confusing for us for a minute. And accidentally made the right decision, which was to kind of just step away for a second. It was during that time that I met Michelle. I started my family. Now, when Dan and I kind of got back together in 2018 and started really hanging out and making music again, it was right after my son Reese was born. You know, my priorities had shifted, and I was no longer self-obsessed or too obsessed with the band. I was like, I had this other person, you know.
Yeah.
Dan had already had that experience with his own kids, and I think we both now can really relate to each other a lot clearer. And we're more hesitant to go do really stupid stuff, like getting asked by a promo director at Warner Brothers to go play like the Spike TV video game awards, doing dumb shit like that.
Yeah.
You know, it really makes you feel like a clown.
You don't feel you're moving the culture on, do you, when you do that kind of thing?
You feel like a bitch, really. You know?
Michelle, you tried being part of a duo once. How did you find it?
I was thinking of the Hall & Oates quote and Dan and Pat's dynamic, and wondering if maybe it's because Patrick is a drummer that he and Dan are able to coexist peacefully. I think when it's two singers, songwriters, it can be a power struggle a bit sometimes. And
yeah,
when we broke up, it was at the height of, you know, our popularity as a duo. And when we broke up, I still maintain that it was more heartbreaking than the divorce with my first husband. The doors had kind of been open for us to do anything we wanted to do, and it was really sad to walk away from that. And the whole thing was just horrible, but I never thought we would ever actually even speak again. A few years ago when I was on tour for Hopeless Romantic, we got back in touch, and I invited her down to the Nashville show to sing a few songs. And it was the first time we'd seen each other since like 2007. And it was actually really cathartic. She got up on stage and sang with me, and it's just instant magic. There's just, you know, a chemistry you have with someone, and you can't repeat it with someone else, no matter how hard you try, and it's always going to be there. And I really see that now, and I'm hopeful maybe one day we'll be able to work together again. We'll see. But I do think when you hear Patrick and Dan, he'll come home from working and play me work tapes or whatever, and there's magic between the two of them. There's a, you know, a certain something, probably the same when you listen to like solo Daryl Hall. And then you listen to, you know, Hall and Oates, and it's like, sorry, there's some magic there.
That's right. Pat saw the Black Keys Wikipedia entry, and it says, Auerbach was captain of the high school soccer team, while Carney was a social outcast. What have you been doing, man? Why would they put that?
I mean, I was a social outcast. I had a group of friends that we were very tight with each other. I spent my high school time not going to parties. In fact, I was never invited to a party, but I would hang out with like older kids who were into music.
Yeah.
The true social outcasts who were like, you know, in their 20s, we worked at the same place, and those dudes would like, you know, show me cool punk rock records and introduce me to stuff like Sun Ra, Space is the Place, and midget porn. I don't know. It was just
like, is that a band or the actual thing?
No, the actual thing.
Okay, oh, God.
Yeah.
That is a great band name, though, I will say.
Yeah. I don't think it's PC to say that, but I don't know what. But anyway, I was.
It was a phase.
I wanted to be in a band. School wasn't really doing it for me. And I found like a little group of people, you know, and I think I started bands and would go play like at the DIY venue in Cleveland. And Dan saw me doing all that stuff. And I think he wanted to be in a band with me because I understood that world, you know.
Michelle, if you were 20 and launching again, you'd be asked to be doing the whole TikTok thing and milking social media. Do you think you could have ever done that? Could you do it now?
I don't know. At plucky 17, 18, I would have been down to do it. But now I don't have the energy.
I'm too cynical for it. Like the whole social influencer taking themselves seriously is so psychotic to me. It's just straight up disturbing. I just assume everyone, like, I can like see the mental illness, like just through all the bullshit with everybody. And, you know, it's, you listen to a Joy Division record and it's not shocking to think that like the singer hung himself. How real and how dark that music is or something, you know, it's real. That's reality. You know, when I'm looking at someone talking directly to their phone about their skincare routine that no one asked them to post this video, I'm like, that's fucking, it's really dark.
Yeah.
It's really fucking dark.
So Pat, how was it for you making a record with Michelle sort of soon after you met? Was that easy? I mean, making a record with your partner, that could be a challenge for a lot of people.
Well, when we initially started making a record, we weren't together. That happened towards the end of making that record. But
okay.
When I met Michelle, yeah, she had all these songs that she had written with other people. And I mean, I think my biggest takeaway from the whole process was just like, she needed someone to advocate for her, you know, creatively, but also like business-wise.
Yeah.
She was taking part in the music industry in a whole different way than I had ever taken part in it, you know?
Like, yeah.
I watched a couple dudes who were record executives basically tell Michelle that what she was making wasn't what she should be making, which no one had ever said anything like that to me, like in that position.
Yeah.
And it was so outrageous to me that I just told her that she needed to fire every single person that she worked with. and she did.
And that was while you were making Hopeless Romantic, was it? They were saying, this isn't what you should be doing.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
And then, you know, get the whole runaround from everybody in the industry. The industry, it's just a big, it's toxic waste dump. You know, it is. It's like, that's why where I came from, you know, it's maybe a harder road sometimes to the top or to even make a career of it. But at least like there's more creative freedom. So I think that we kind of helped Michelle get her away from that shit.
I've always thought the music business was spectacularly bad at aftercare. You know, having got someone into a position where they're famous, they just abandon them. People don't know how to sustain an artist once they've, you know, marketed them into position or whatever.
Yeah, it's like Michelle. When I met Michelle, like I couldn't wrap my head around the fact that this musician had sold 6 million records for Warner Brothers and then got dropped. You know, in my mind, you're good. You should be allowed to release your musical experiments. But she was never allowed to do that. They had shelved like two or three of her albums, and it really triggered me. Being around that, I never knew that was like reality. And
it's really frustrating to have two albums back to back. You turn them in, you know, you do your photo shoot, the record, the album art's being made, you do music videos, everyone's on board. And then it all comes to a screeching halt because the label president gets fired and they hire a new person who comes in and says, you know, oh, maybe you should keep working or maybe you should change it because they want to put their stamp on it. And that happened to me back to back twice. And it just, it messes with your head because you're, it's just music. Why can't I just put it out and move on? You're kind of stuck in this kind of hamster wheel.
At one point we had a president, former president of Warner Brothers, who had said something that got back to me, which was that someone was asking him about, you know, working with the Black Keys. And he's like, I really helped nurture that band by just staying out of the way, which is basically, he was taking credit for our success by never helping us once, which is fucking amazing, dude. That's the,
well, he may have had a point though, from what you're saying, that the people that do get involved usually just fuck it up, don't they?
Yeah, that would have, I would have loved to have someone not involved in my career.
Do you think we're close to the moment when labels, record companies, whatever they're going to be called, are irrelevant for new acts?
No, I don't think so, because the politics in music are so real. And like, all you have to do is watch the Grammys to see it's a political show. It's not even like a popularity contest. It's, there's some other back channeling happening. And if you're not convinced by that, then all you have to do is open up any streaming service and look at what's getting prioritized and why. And why does certain songs have like 600 million streams and other songs don't, you know? And I think having a label is going to be a necessity for bands who want to kind of break through to larger audiences, I think, for a long time.
But at the same time, the social media and everything allows people to launch records and get a worldwide audience
but have you ever posted something and not advertised it on social media? It gets completely shut down.
Yeah.
Like there's so much gatekeeping, man, that in a perfect world, you could put your song on Bandcamp and you could become like a Post Malone or whatever. There's so much good music that gets unheard.
Yeah.
But the point is, a record could come out on a major label and without the right push, even then it doesn't get fucking heard at all. That's what was going on your whole podcast.
Yes.
The situation of great records, like this record I've selected, is one of the most influential records for me. And dude, it took me years to find a copy of this thing when I was a teenager.
We'll come on to that. But yes, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? About what endures despite the best efforts of the music industry to bury it. Willie, let me ask you a question so I can hear you there. Oh, hello. Are you full now? Is she satiated?
She's never satiated.
Thanks very much for filling in your questionnaires. And I thought they were fascinating responses. Michelle, one thing I loved was the difference between the first record that you ever asked for was a Pebble single, Mercedes Boy, which is great. And then the most recent record you got so excited about, you said, was Yard Act album, the Overload.
It's a long way from A to Z there.
That's brilliant. You're both born in the 80s, so I thought it was significant that the record that you both selected as one that significantly shifted your musical taste was Nirvana's Nevermind, which came out in 91, didn't it? So you were both pretty young when you heard that. But can you remember the sort of before and after sensation of listening to music with that album?
Well, I wasn't even 10 years old yet. And the only reason I heard it was because I have a brother who's 4 years older. My mom didn't want me and my younger sister watching MTV. If my dad and my mom left the house, my brother would be in charge of us. And we would literally run to the window and watch the car pull out of the driveway, wait till the garage door closed, and run to the TV and turn MTV on. And, you know, I remember that being the first place I heard Nirvana, was seeing the video on MTV. Before that, it was a lot of like hair bands happening from my brother's room. So yeah. It was really mind-blowing to hear Nirvana for the first time.
Pat, what about you? You were 11, right, when that came out?
Yeah, I was in sixth grade, 11 years old. My brother had gotten a copy of it, of Nevermind, on cassette probably in November of 91. Mm-hmm. And very familiar by the time they played SNL, which was early January of 92. It was around that same time I spent the night at my friend Steve's house. He had a red electric guitar. And I was like, what? You can just have one of those? He's like, yeah, man. You can just have an electric guitar. He plugged it in and started playing, you know, some power chords. And I think that's so cool. And I begged my dad for like a whole year, like for a guitar for Christmas. And my dad was introducing me to a bunch of music. And I went on this kind of crash course. I was always like the Beatles, and I liked the Rolling Stones, and I liked Weird Al Yankovic and stuff. But I was a little bit confused until Nirvana came around. I got a guitar for Christmas the following year. And within a year after that, I was asking for a 4-track recorder and was just completely obsessed with music. But the Nirvana record to me changed everything, because my dad listened to rock. I didn't feel the need to like rebel against any of that stuff. I was always attracted to it, but by having a band that was like my band, I think it helped separate. It made it feel less lame than just listening to my dad's music. Something.
You said that your most recent record you got excited about was the latest one by Guided by Voices. When did you discover them? Because they go way back, don't they?
I think I discovered them about 95, 94, around B-1000.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, because the first time I heard them was Vampire on Titus, which is one of their strangest sounding records, isn't it? And I, what are they doing? And it put me off them for a while, because the vocal is so weird on that record.
The whole Robert Pollard story to me is like, it was something that was always aspirational. Here's this guy that became a school teacher, but he had his band and wrote songs, and he would make records in his basement, and he did it. Even like put his first record out till he was, you know, in his early 30s. The whole thing there, when I was a teenager and, you know, leading up to, you know, making a record with Dan, I was telling myself like, it's okay to have a backup plan. It's okay to do all this stuff. One day it could all.
Yeah.
He's one of the most underrated musicians of all time, you know.
But it's great that somebody's story can have a reassuring effect upon you. You know what I mean? It could be like counseling, can't it? Like, don't worry, whatever.
I was subscribing to these stories left and right. Like, what, you know, being from Akron, you know, my dad got me a Devo Live CD when I was 15. It was Devo Live, the Mongoloid years. The CD, the liner notes were just so fascinating. It was the story of, you know, these guys making their own recordings at home. And, you know, getting in a van and driving to New York and playing at Max's Kansas City and not having any money to stay there and having to get in a van and drive right back. And then their phone was ringing off the hook the next day from executives from Warner Brothers. And honestly, like the way that Dan and I's career ended up happening, there were moments that were not far fetched from that story that I was wanting to be my life. You know, we definitely drove to New York and then drove right back after opening for a ska band. There's no Max's Kansas City in the picture. There was no Andy Warhol at our show. There was a ska band called the Pie Tasters that we opened for. but within a couple of days of that, we were getting calls from Seymour Stein.
You know? Wow, really? God, he's always first man on the phone, isn't he? Incredible.
Yeah,
his radar.
He flew to Cleveland to see us when we were 22. You know, hung out with us. It was crazy.
Well, look, I'm mindful we could carry on talking for hours. So let's turn to the records you've brought in to talk about today. Michelle, should we start with your choice from 1998? It's Patty Griffin and Flaming Red. And let's just hear a little bit of it. And then you can tell us all about it.
Yeah.
Let's take a ride to the seaside. We can go out swimming in the high tide. Just wear your shorts and your long. Everybody's gone and it's groovy. They went to the one bathroom.
That's Patty Griffin from her second album, Flaming Red, 1998. And the songs you heard there were One Big Love, Tony, and Change. So, Michelle, you were about 15 when this came out. Is that right? What was it about this record that spoke to you then?
I just met my first manager, Jeff, and he was managing this band out of Mississippi called Still Stanley, a rock band. And the guitar player, Will Golden, we asked him if he would help me do some demos to shop around to labels and help make a little indie record for me to have to sell at shows. And Will got in his truck from LA and came to Sedona, Arizona, and had with him a bunch of mixtapes that he thought I would like to hear. And he gave me Patty Griffin, Flaming Red, and was like, I think this is right up your alley. I think you'd love this. And I remember hearing it and being completely out of my mind, excited about it. It was on such heavy rotation. I just fell in love with her melodies, her writing, and I loved the way it was produced. I loved, there's a song called Mary that's a ballad and you hear acoustic guitars, but that she was also making rock music. It was one of the first things that I really fell in love with that none of my friends knew. It gave me kind of a feeling of sense of ownership about it and excitement. I listened to One Big Love when you were just playing that clip, and I remember getting off the bus from school and walking home with that on the headphones after school and just being thinking I was the character of some movie and that was the song playing. It just definitely brings me back. It's still one of my most favorite records.
Have you met her subsequently by any chance?
She's had a lot of success with the Dixie Chicks covering a lot of her songs. I was asked to open up for them on tour after their big kind of debacle here in the US where they made a comment about President Bush, and I was opening for them on that tour, and they were giving me a bootleg acoustic Patty songs. One of the songs was a song called One More Girl. And I went on to record that as one of the album tracks with the Wreckers on our album, and ended up going to see Patty while we were on tour and meeting her after we'd covered One More Girl. And it was kind of long way to go, but it was a cool way to finally meet her, having been introduced through, you know, the Dixie Chicks and finding the song from the Dixie Chicks and covering it and then meeting her after we had done it. And she's just amazing. She's still one of my favorite songwriters.
One of the songs that you mentioned that you really liked on this album, Tony, is really interesting. I mean, it's one of those songs that you probably wouldn't write it this way now, would you, if you were going to write this song? The lyric could be taken the wrong way by some people nowadays.
Yeah.
But it's very heartfelt. How do you feel about that now? Do you feel it's a shame that someone can't be as sort of bold as that in a song these days?
Oh, not only in a song, but in their day-to-day life.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like with cancel culture, it's just so hard to be in a position where you're worried about, you know, saying the right thing or the wrong thing. Is just very interesting place to be. I mean, my daughter Owen, you know, has friends who have all changed their pronouns and whatnot, and Owen gets really upset if we accidentally say the wrong pronoun and jumps down our throats. She's like the most judgmental person in a way about people who don't understand that or doesn't give the grace to her mom to try to be like, oh yeah, maybe my mom isn't used to this stuff yet. And, you know, got my friend's pronoun wrong. We're in an interesting time for creative people to have to watch what they're saying. It just doesn't really go hand in hand with, you know, rock and roll, does it?
No. I mean, and what's a shame is in a song like this, Tony, the presence of the word faggot might sort of set off alarm bells for some people, and they'd either get kind of outraged by it without realizing the sort of sense of irony or support, or feel that they're protecting someone by not making the song available and not taking into account the intent of the original work.
Well, when I remember hearing that song, you know, at 15 years old and being so heartbroken by the lyric and the story that she was telling, and knowing, really inspired that she wrote about that and that it was so to the point, and that you could see yourself in the lyric, knowing that, you know, you could be sitting in class with someone who's struggling that way. And it's always been a favorite song of mine. because of the way she tackles the topic. I don't think I've really ever heard sitting behind a gay boy in school and later finding out he's killed himself.
I'd be interested to know what Owen and her friends made of it as well. That would be intriguing.
You know, yeah, I don't know if Owen's ever heard that song. I'll have to play it for her today.
Pat, did this kind of music mean anything to you when you were you were kicking around at this age?
Doubt it.
I never heard that record, no, but I had a girlfriend who was really into like Todd Snyder and John Prine, and so I would listen to all that stuff when I was in high school.
Yeah.
But then when I broke up with her, I couldn't listen to any of that stuff. In fact, I thought it was all so stupid that except for John Prine. But even the John Prine, I thought the songs were just so sad that I just was like not interested in really listening to that. It was too heavy, like Sam Stone or like his, you know, Hello in there. I was just like, man, this is too much for me.
You know, you didn't have all that estrogen coursing through your veins like I did.
Maybe teenage girls are just like naturally like,
we just want to listen to music and be sad.
Maybe you're on the same emotional level as just like a 45-year-old male alcoholic. I don't know. But around that time, I was really deep into like Modest Mouse, I guess. Around, was that like 96, 97?
Yeah.
I was into
And to me, that's like way more emotional. Modest Mouse is way more emotional to me than Patty Griffin.
No, but there's a frustrated anger that it comes with Modest Mouse that really resonated with me.
Hearing her go from, you know, acoustic singer-songwriter record to being so heavy was something that excited me as someone who was making acoustic music and wanting to be with a band and wanting to be produced with a band and hearing how that sounded. I think that's kind of what really inspired me the most was seeing how she could take these songs that were written on acoustic guitar and they could sound as heavy and big as they were. You know, who knows? I would imagine that maybe her first record was the way it was because that's all that, you know, you could afford or all you had access to at that time. And then
the story I heard about the first record was that it was produced by Nile Rodgers, and then they removed all his work or something. The record company decided it was overproduced, and they ended.
Oh my God! Where is that record?
They ended up.
We need to find that record.
They ended up putting out the demos or something. But I don't know. Like I thought, Nile Rodgers. I can't believe it, but maybe
that doesn't make sense. Yeah. But if it exists, someone. Send us the bootlegs, please.
Do you know her later albums? Impossible Dreams, a really good record. I was late onto her, and that was the one that where I first heard her, and I thought it was fantastic.
It seems everything she puts out, there's always at least one or two songs that I hear, and it's just so inspiring as a writer.
They're all very long records as well, aren't they? She writes a lot of material.
Yeah.
You know, she seems pretty prolific, and she's kind of kept on going ever since, really, hasn't she?
I know she's hitting the road with the Dixie Chicks this summer, and I was really anxious to go see a show, and I went and looked up the dates, and they're not coming through Nashville, which was really disappointing, and so I'm hoping maybe I get to catch a show and see her out with the Dixie Chicks. But then I wonder if she'll be able to play some of her songs that the Chicks later play in their set. Yeah. Like, how will that work?
First on gets first crack at Mary or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Well, thanks for introducing me to this album. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Michelle.
Yeah.
Pat, let's turn to your album. It's by The Feelies. It's called Crazy Rhythms. Let's remind ourselves how that goes.
Yeah. nothing done. The sun is bare, but not now. Can't relax, there's things to do. Make plans, stay while little ones appear. It's nice to know when it's part of your life. I don't want much and I need even less. It's time to sacrifice.
Fresh out of New Jersey in 1980, that's the Feelies, Crazy Rhythms. You heard Far Say La, Forces at Work, Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except Me and My Monkey, and Crazy Rhythms. So, Pat, tell us about this record.
My friends, I used to watch a show on MTV that was on Sunday nights called 120 Minutes. And it was the only time that MTV played, kind of alternative music that was to our liking. My friend Steve would tape it. Usually we would watch it like at a sleepover on Friday nights or something. And one episode, there was a song by this band called Luna. It was a song called Chinatown off their record Penthouse. We were kind of like, getting into melodic kind of music after listening to just nothing but Sonic Youth and the Boredoms, which were introduced to us by, via Nirvana. And I guess we were kind of, it was like our punk thing was that we were going to listen to music that was really like melodic. So we got really into Luna and Dean Wareham, and this is like 1996, probably 95. I'm sitting in chemistry class next to my friend Steve, and he's like, dude, check out what I just got. Pulls out this little box set. He's like, this is Dean Wareham's band before Luna. He was in this band called Galaxy 500. And I was like, oh yeah, is it good? He's like, yeah, I think you'll dig it. He's like, but this is what's crazy. I want to show you this. And he opens up the the booklet. He's like, look, your uncle played on this record. Your uncle played saxophone. And I was like, what? And I knew Ralph would play, played on some cool stuff or whatever. But I was like, this is weird. And it was basically like, this is the beginning of the music world that I was into just becoming really small and realizing how connected it is. Just a bunch of nerds who kind of just influence each other. Yes. And it made me start thinking like, well, what other bands were the guys in Luna in? Dean had this other band. And then I feel like, oh, Justin Hayward was in the Chills. So I was like, I've got to go get a Chills record. So I had a little list, mental list. Stanley Demesky, the drummer from Luna, was in a band called the Feelies. And I was talking to my friend at a record store. He's like, oh yeah, the Feelies. Yeah, they have this one record called Crazy Rhythms. I think you'd really dig it. And I was like, well, can I order it? He's like, no, it's out of print. It's out of print. So every time I went into a record store for like 2 years, I would go straight to the F section and look for Crazy Rhythm. And finally one day, like I found a used copy of it on CD. It was such a big deal to like me and a couple of friends. I was like, oh my God, I found it. We can finally hear this record. And that anticipation that it was put it on this pedestal to me, that I was like, the CD's strange, the record's mastered kind of sequence strange. At the top of a few songs, there's just a minute of silence. I was like, is the CD broken? Is it working? there's this crazy percussion on the record. I remember hearing it the first time and looking through the booklet, and like the credits were like so-and-so tom, so-and-so snare drum, woodblock. Was every member sitting there recording like the drums separately? And I had no idea how it was made. I'd never heard a record that sounded like this. And in fact, it was so obscure. Every time I would find a copy of that on tour, I would buy it, which only happened like three times. It's a pretty rare record. Then it got reissued like not that long ago. But the drummer of the Feelies on that record, Anton Fier, is actually from Cleveland. He's from like, I had this whole image of this band and how mysterious they were. And like, here it is, the drummer's just from Cleveland. It was in Perry Ubu. And it turns out like everything kind of cool is connected somehow to Akron or Cleveland. Because it's all so small. And I remember talking to Uncle Ralph about playing on the Galaxy 500 song. He's like, oh yeah, I got $50 for that. That's all I remember. For me, like being a kid, in a small town, not as small as Sedona, obviously, but a small town like Akron, where I was still kind of, there was an attachment to, I knew what the pulse of, the underground music, but I had no way to access it. Anytime I could get a glimpse of what like was happening at like in New York City at the Mercury Lounge, or what happened at Max's Kansas City in the 70s, it was so fascinating to me. And it was like up between this record for my selection or A Marquee Moon by Television. They both had the same kind of impact on me. And, you know, I remember talking about music with my Uncle Ralph, and I was like, oh yeah, you know, have you ever heard the band Television? Like, of course he has. What an idiot, me asking like an OG hipster. You know, he's like, Patrick, their last shows ever, we opened for them at the Bottom Line in New York. And I was like, what the fuck? It's just such a small world. And the craziest thing, the smallest world part of this is that Anton Fier, the drummer from the Feelies, was not only in Peri Uber for a minute, but he was also in the Voidoids with Dan's cousin for a minute.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But yeah, to talk about the actual record, the actual record, I don't know. I'm not very good at describing music. I just know that the facts of this record are Weezer completely ripped off the record cover for their Blue album. That's a known fact. And it was released on A&M, and it was, at the time it was released, I've read, it was the most expensive independent recording ever made at like $30,000 or something. And it sounds immaculate. It sounds incredible. And it's a very unusual record.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, here's a weird thing. I got this album when it came out in 1980.
Amazing.
John Peel liked them a lot, and of course, over here, and he was playing them all the time. And Farsi La was a single, and he used to play that quite a lot. And I thought it was quite reminiscent of the Modern Lovers or something, you know, and the reviews were great. And I seem to recall it was marketed at a bargain price. It was on Stiff Records in the UK, and they put it out at a sort of cheap price. So I got a copy, and I was completely baffled by it, I have to say. I ended up doing that thing of sort of pretending to be enthusiastic about it and playing it to a few friends, going, look how cool I am, I've got this album. But no one else was that bothered, and I found I wasn't going back to it as much as I maybe ought to have done. There were three things that threw me. The sequencing, I think it starts with the dullest song on the album, The Boy with the Perpetual Nervousness. I don't know what you feel, but I don't think that's a great way to start this record. And I was also slightly put off by their tendency to stay on the same note or chord for sometimes a whole song.
My favorite song on the record was Raised Eyebrows.
Okay.
I think the mystique around it had created, you know, I just had so much patience for the record when I listened to it.
I think that's brilliant. I'm waiting to hear something for 2 years must be a brilliant way into a record, isn't it? That must really make you want to love it.
Oh, I did. And that's like, you know, the fact that I had it, my friends were like, I was like, you know, I really put the time in. But that's, you know, that's part of, you know, listening to records, as you know, like the punishment you'd have to put yourself through to get yourself your head around something. My friends and I were all really into Pavement, and at our local record store, the Silver Jews records were filed in the Pavement section. So I bought all the Pavement records, and I bought Starlight Walker, the Silver Jews first record. And I remember I put it on, and I did not get it. I hated it, in fact. And I sent it, my friend Steve asked if he could borrow it. This is my buddy who, you know, showed me the Galaxy 500 thing, showed me the electric guitar, big, huge influence on me. And he borrowed it. And a couple of weeks later, he's like, dude, that Silver Jews record's amazing. I was like, really? I guess I should give it another thing. He's like, you really should, right? And he gave it back. And because he liked it, I sat down with it and I listened to it. And then I listened to it with him. And I was like, I totally got it. I totally understood it. And I missed the whole point initially. But a lot of music was like that for me. You know, I just like missed the point.
I just have a question, Jim, and listening to it again now after, you know, your initial kind of thoughts about the record, how do you feel about it on second listen or, you know, coming back to
it? I really noticed its kind of youthful spirit. It seems to capture sort of lightning in a bottle a bit, doesn't it? As you say, the recording is good, but it's still slightly oddly balanced. Like the way they mix the vocals, I think is strange, but I love the sense of there's an innocence to it. Like they don't know any different. This is what the beginning of a band sounds like. Come on, guys, let's make a record. It's got that kind of feel about it, hasn't it? Let's do something.
That's exactly right. It's somebody. It's like I can relate to the idea of like going in the studio and be like, let's do this thing a little bit different, and because it's different, it's good.
Yeah,
and that can be the case. It's like when I hear, you know, the Stooges' first record, I feel that too. I'm like, okay, let's put the solo all the way to the left up like 20 dB over the rest of the music. And I always loved that. I always thought that was so good. you know.
I'd be intrigued to know if the Feelies were aware of any krautrock or anything, because Forces at Work is like Noi, isn't it, almost? It's got that relentless sort of motoric rhythm and hanging on one chord. Yeah.
I was just talking to Ralph about what he would listen to in high school, and they all had the same, all my Uncle Ralph's friends had the same thing. They were like, they were all into Soft Machine. And and then from there, they got into like Kevin Ayers, then they got into the drummer, Robert Wyatt, and then they're going to Gong, and from there it's like Roxy Music, and it's just they're into like Noi, and then they've come out the other side. Like, you know, music was just so fun back then, you know. And I listened to all that shit, because when my uncle moved to New York, he left most of his records at the time from then back at my grandparents' house. So I just took them into my bedroom, and I had like Stockhausen records when I was 15, just trying to process what the fuck what is this shit. But I knew what it was. Like, I knew that there was some hipster out there that would be so impressed with this record that I didn't understand that at one point I used the Stockhausen record as like just leverage to kind of get into like the indie scene in Cleveland, because at the time there was no internet and there's no way to find out about like the DIY shows unless someone called you. And I was all the way down in Akron. I needed to know what was going on. So there was this record store, and the guy was obsessed with, like, at the time, I think they called it intelligent dance music. It was just like electronic music. And I knew that like the Stockhausen was like the most snobby like thing that you could be talking about. And I took this record up to him and I was like, hey, I want you to have this. And he's like, oh, how much do you want for this? I was like, no, you can just have it. And it was like, he's like, are you serious? I'm like, yeah. And from that point on, I knew when every show was happening in Cleveland. The original payola.
Wow. There can't be many people who've wormed their way into society with a Stockhausen record. That's great. Did this sort of influence your approach to the drums at all, this record?
I think so, because when I started playing the drums, I honestly, God, didn't realize that they were supposed to keep time in the song. I really didn't. I thought they were like there to accompany the guitar, and that's how I approached drums for at least the first three or four albums that Dan and I made. It wasn't really until I met Danger Mouse he worked with us, and he was like, yeah, you should try to like keep the beat steady through the song or something. I was like, really? I kind of think it's cool when like it goes, he's like, yeah, that's not really
what you're for.
Not, he's like, it works. He was actually really cool about it. He's like, no, I don't want you to not do that thing, but like, here's why you shouldn't do it on this song. I then, at the age of, you know, about 30, had to start trying to learn how to keep time, which I'm still not very good at, honestly. You know, I grew up listening to like poorly cut samples on like Cypress Hill records, where there's a little bit of lopsidedness to it, and which the appeal to me was always that kind of funky, weird shit.
Well, it's a bit like singers who've learned to sound like autotune, isn't it? There must be a generation of drummers who've learned to sound like bad samples.
Well, I think there are. I think there's a generation of drummers who've learned to play really way too tight. You know, it'd be like the drummers who learned to play to a warped record. That's why.
That's fascinating. I didn't realize. So you say on the first few Black Keys albums, you're just playing along. Is that what you?
I'm just playing my parts that I wrote that go along with the drums or with the guitar. Yeah, I mean, you can really hear on a song. There's a song that we do a cover of Leaving Trunk on our first record. And if you listen to that, you can really hear that's what I'm doing. That's why it sounds so fucking weird. At the time, I thought it sounded amazing.
We see, I always thought that's roughly what John Bonham was doing in Led Zeppelin. I always thought Jimmy Page was holding the rhythm down and John Bonham was following him. That's what it felt like to me. Do you think that's true at all?
I think in a good band, the band's doing that. They're playing together, you know.
Yeah.
In a boring band, the drummer's leading the whole thing and not listening. I learned to play listening to Dan. Like, that's why I play the drums the best when I'm just listening to the person I'm playing with.
Yeah, I think that's true. The best drummers are always the sort of personality drummers, I think, aren't they? And they don't have to be incredible technicians, but they just do their own thing and bring a lot of atmosphere to a record. I mean, you think of somebody like, you know, Keith Moon or whatever, couldn't keep time to save his life, but totally the making of the Who in his own way. And we're about to come on to another one of those, a drummer that other drummers can't replicate.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that, you know, the sign of a great musician is when you hear that. I mean, it's easy with a singer because your voice is so unique. As a singer, you know, you're going to be able to identify it. But as an instrumentalist, like, if you can hear someone play something and be like, that could be this guy. Yeah. Like, you know, imagine how hard it is to do that on the bass guitar. You know, it's hard. Yes. It's really hard. But there are some bassists where you're like, okay, that's got to be this dude. I really wanted to be a guitar player. I just was like the shittiest guitar player out of all my friends. So I had to play the drums. Yeah.
you were sent to the back of the room.
I was demoted to the drums.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good. Okay, well, let's come on to my choice here. And this features a very distinctive drummer from 1973. The album's called Mystery to Me, and it's Fleetwood Mac. Let's hear it.
Yes, the same kind of story seems to come down from long ago. Two friends having coffee together when something flies by their window. It might be out on that lawn, which is wide, at least half of a playing field. Because there's no explaining, your imagination can make you see and feel. Your body wants nothing, you know you're hypnotized. She sails away small.
That's Fleetwood Mac from Mystery to Me, 1973. And the songs you heard there were Hypnotized, Emerald Eyes, Forever, and Why. This is a comparatively recent discovery for me. I finally heard it about 4 years ago. It was a record I was vaguely aware of in the record racks when I was a kid, but I'd never heard it. But when I did hear it, I was instantly charmed by it. I mean, as a kid, I really loved Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, that run of singles from Black Magic Woman to Green Man Alishi via Albatross, Man of the World, and Oh Well is, for my money, one of the most extraordinary runs in pop history. And when I hit my teens, there was the Buckingham Nicks iteration of the Mac, which was inescapable, of course. But between those were 5 years when the band was struggling, surviving, and evolving. Six albums, all of which sold enough in the US to keep the band on their label, Reprise. But they went unnoticed in the UK, really. And they're mostly pretty good. Bob Welch's first album with the band, Future Games, and the one where Danny Kirwin takes charge, Bare Trees, each have their devotees. And I'd say they only really made one stinker, which was an album called Penguin in 1973, which is not good. But then later that same year, they released this. It's the album where Bob Welch, who's the singer you heard on most of those tracks there, he sort of ascends to the front of the record and inadvertently invents the sort of future sound of the Mac. This is the record where the kind of laid-back West Coast sound, those easy grooves and the stacked harmonies, where they'd soon become famous for, they first start to sound magical. And those are Welch's stock in trade. I mean, Christine McVie has said many times that Bob Welch helped her find the sound that she became famous for. And you can hear it developing on this record. But it's Welch's songs that stand out, I think. The opening, Emerald Eyes, was a single. The Hypnotized, which is great, that arresting drum shuffle intro. The reggae-flavoured Forever. A song called Miles Away that's really pumping and features John McVie sounding more agitated than he ever has. There's some Gut Bucket Blues on there. There's a funky blues song called Somebody. There's a song called Keep On Going, which gives Christine an appropriate setting for a voice with lovely fluttering strings by the great Richard Hewson, and a sort of proto-disco groove, which is quite early for that. It's a remarkable development on many levels. And there's a couple of not-so-good songs on there. Most of the time, I think it hits the target. Song after song really does it. And I tell you who plays a blinder all the way through this album, it's Mick Fleetwood. His drumming is brilliant. Beautifully recorded, too, by Martin Birch. There's little touches like the sub-boom they put into Emerald Eyes and his congas on a cover of For Your Love, which are great. That it's a really good album, and therefore it's such a shame that they put it in one of the very worst sleeves I've ever seen. It's a badly rendered caricature of a gorilla eating a Victoria sponge cake on a beach, something like that. Just describing it makes me squirm. It's almost as if someone in marketing was trying to nobble the band and snuck it into production without their knowledge. I can't believe that anyone with any taste saw this cover and thought it was a good idea. It was done by somebody called Modular. The credits with the cover design. They'd actually done Penguin, which isn't awful, and they'd gone to do albums for Camel, which were perfectly fine. But this is a genuinely off-putting image, and maybe the factor why this excellent record isn't better known. You know, it'd be interesting to think that if that were the case, that Fleetwood Mac might have taken off again a lot sooner if someone hadn't designed a terrible cover for them. Because I really think this is a good record. Did either of you know it at all? Had you ever heard it before?
No, I never heard it. And I, you know, growing up in Arizona, Fleetwood Mac was a big deal because Stevie was from Arizona as well. And so I'm surprised I hadn't heard of it. Who's singing, who's doing the vocal on the third song? I couldn't tell if it was Christine or someone else.
That was Bob Welch. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Because it sounds like Christine's phrasing, and it's amazing.
There are moments when their harmonies come together, Bob and Christine, and they really sound like Christine with Lindsay and Stevie. You know,
yeah.
They get a really good blend. And she's said subsequently that he kind of taught her how to harmonize really well. And you can hear that. You can hear that on this record.
It's awesome as a fan to hear the origin of that. That's amazing. I was thinking about this story while you guys were talking about drumming before we got to this album. Years ago, I was asked to do a country music covers Fleetwood Mac record for Target or something. I went in and recorded a Say You Love Me. And my manager at the time also managed Stevie. And Stevie came down to the studio and said she wanted to sing harmonies on it with me. And it was, just an amazing, surreal experience to have Stevie down to the studio to sing harmony on a Fleetwood Mac song. It's a shame it actually, the record never got released. Oh. But Abe Laboriel Jr. was on drums. Stevie wasn't happy with the way that the track sounded. Here's the drums that Abe Jr. played. You know, he's phenomenal, proficient drummer. And she was like, it's the drums. Something's wrong with the drums. And we're looking at her like, what's wrong with the drums? It's Abe. It's an amazing, perfect take. And she was like, no, it's perfect. It's too perfect. She's like, it's got to be a dance with the vocal. The way Mick plays is he's listening to me sing, and he doesn't play like a drummer. He's listening to me and he's playing parts with me.
Yeah.
And I was the first time that I kind of heard that spelled out in that way of, here's Abe playing the song perfectly. And she wants it to not be, she wants it to be an answer to what we're doing. And it made complete sense. And I love hearing this record. I'm going to go dive into it now after you've introduced me to it. So thank you for that.
I interviewed all of Fleetwood Mac when they got back together again for that tour, you know,
which time?
Well, yeah, when Christine last rejoined before they kicked Lindsay out, they had the original five, if you like, the Rumours five back together again on tour. And Mick or John explained it to me, I think it was John, that the reason it works is that John is playing behind the beat and Mick's playing slightly ahead. And that's their groove. It's why it's so, one of the reasons it's so distinctive is that one of them's holding back and one of them's pushing it forward. And you just get that lovely tension between the
push
two
and
of them.
Pull, yeah.
All the time. Patrick, what about you? Did you ever have any interest in Fleetwood Mac growing up?
I mean, I definitely grew up hearing Rumours, you know, it was omnipresent, but I was not familiar with Peter Green, Fleetwood Mac until not that long ago, maybe 10 years ago, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
Dan and I were driving somewhere. He put on Oh Well, and I was like, this is insane.
This is so, yeah, so good, isn't it?
You know, then the whole lore with like the Peter Green, like Les Paul, and his guitar sounds a certain way because the guitar pickups are apparently miswired and out of phase. And
yeah,
we had Joe Walsh come and play with us at the Forum last time we were in LA.
Yeah,
we did a couple songs by this band called the All Saved Freak Band, this like offshoot of a guitar player who was in the James Gang back in Cleveland, who had like an acid casualty and became like a born again Christian and started like one of the first Christian rock bands that was really just this super heavy band, and they had called the All Saved Freak Band. Anyway, we're talking to Joe Walsh, and it came up where he was talking about, you know, living in Kent, Ohio, and Akron, and he got this Les Paul from this little guitar shop in Akron, which is still in business, called Lay's, and how he sold it to or gave it to Jimmy Page. And I was like, what? Fucking Led Zeppelin guitar? It's from fucking Akron. I had no idea until, like, you know, I was about almost 40 years old. But, I mean, if I would have known that as a kid growing up, when I was walking around to Akron, being like, the guitar used to play Whole Lotta Love is required in this town. I mean, fuck. But when I listened to that Fleetwood Mac album you just played, it's just like, you know, there's this band that has a record that is so omnipresent. Everybody knows, you know, every song on it. But yet, here's still a record by this band I've never heard, and it's really good. It's crazy.
Yes. How do you rate Mick as a drummer?
Great. Amazing. I think the simplicity is good. I think the shuffle, you know, the little swing he has is really cool.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about the, like, drooping testicle accessory he wears, but I could do without that.
He's taller than you, Pat.
Not anymore, probably, but yeah. We're all shrinking. Oh,
man, I mean, this was only a few years ago when I met them, and he fills a doorway still. You know, he has to duck to come into any room.
I guarantee you, his balls are bigger than mine, too. So.
Well, he does still make good use of the dangly balls on stage. And, I mean, I was stunned how energetic they were. They were, you know, they were in their 70s.
Crazy, right? Man. It's crazy.
Yeah, and he could really go, and he was doing it for hours. You know, the show that I saw in LA was about 3 hours long. I mean, Lindsay was the only one that was on stage the entire time. I think they all had a rest at some point. But, yeah, the stamina of that band is just extraordinary.
Damn it, Jim. I was at that show.
Oh, were you? That was a stunning show, I thought. It, you know, for people in their 70s, it was incredible work, wasn't it?
Yeah. I will always be a huge fan of them. One of my first musical memories being in the back of the car, and my mom was in the front seat with a girlfriend of hers, and they were listening to Rumors and singing every word, and I was, you know, a kid in the back seat, and I remember it so vividly. And I think just because they were from Arizona, and it meant so much to me as a young musician, knowing that, you know, Stevie was from Arizona.
Do you think that's a function of America? Because it's so big, those connections feel that much more important. They feel that much more sort of random and, oh, wow, there is a chance to get out of this town, you know?
Yeah, I mean, England's about the size of Ohio. When you are in a place like Sedona and the closest town is Phoenix, and, you know, like the Touchstones musically, all you've got Alice Cooper and Stevie Nicks. Is there anything else?
Linda Ronstadt and Megadeth.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Tool, Maynard from Tool lives in a nearby.
See, that's it. That's our actual connection, is that Maynard's actually from like Akron, but now lives in Phoenix. It's like, that's our.
He's your connective tissue is Maynard from Tool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very good. In about 1978, there was an attempt, wasn't there, to sell Akron as this groovy musical hub. And that compilation came out on Stiff over here with a scratch and sniff tire sleeve with Jane Eyre and the Belvederes and Rachel Sweet and the Waitresses and all that kind of thing. Presumably, it was just after Devo had taken off. Were you aware of that growing up? Was that still sort of reverberating?
Yeah, because I even you know, as a teenager, like, you know, the echoes of that, like Akron being the next Athens, Georgia, or whatever, we're still kind of, I think it's like, you know, the explanation is for why there's bands like that that come from Cleveland and Akron and Detroit is similar to why there's bands that come from like Glasgow and Bristol or Manchester, is that there's not fucking anything else to do. Yes. And the weather's terrible, so you're gonna just like sit in your house and like learn an instrument or, you know,
go to the pub.
Well, someone once told me that's why there was no rock and roll
in Florida.
No, in France, because they all still had conscription there. So all the boys, when they were about 17, 18, just about thinking of getting into bands, got lumped into the army for 2 years. So that just killed off everyone's interest in being in a rock band.
Dan and I, we were the only people who we knew who were into the same shit. Now, I don't think it would be as hard to find, you know, other people, obviously, who are into similar stuff. But we were lucky in the fact that we were kind of stuck with each other, and we learned to play, and we developed, like, deep bond, and we have this language now that, like, you know, I don't know if kids would have the patience to do all that nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it's necessary. Who knows?
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing Dropout Boogie. Good luck with it.
Thanks.
You're about to go on tour and all that?
Yeah. We're going to do that. Hopefully we'll be coming to Europe next year. We have a few little things to do this year over there, but it's been almost 10 years since we've toured England.
So. Wow. Really? Is it that long?
I know. Yeah.
Gosh. Well, good luck with it all. And Michelle, tell me about your new record then. You've got a new album waiting to come out. Is that right?
Yeah. I have an album called The Trouble with Fever. And it's coming out on Nonesuch in mid-September. And Patrick produced it, and we made it during lockdown here at the house.
How do you feel about being back with Warner Brothers?
It's an all new cast of characters. You know, the funny thing about the music business is when people get fired in the music business, they just get rehired in a better position at another company, and they just kind of regurgitate each other and end up, you know, leaving but never truly leaving. And it makes me laugh that I'm back on Warner Brothers. It's like you know, the bad boyfriend I can't quit, but but I'm excited it's coming out, and it'll be an adventure for sure.
Are you going to tour together at any point? Are you
I doubt it. When I heard that he's potentially going to Europe next year, I'm just definitely going as a visitor.
Good luck with it all. And thank you so much for talking to me today, because I really enjoyed it. And I really enjoyed listening to those albums again.
Likewise.
Fascinating to hear the Feelies again after so long, and being introduced to early Patti, which I didn't realise she was like that back then. That was fascinating. Also, I didn't realise about Patti until I researched that she lived with Robert Plant for 4 years.
Yes. Yes. It's very scandalous.
Yeah, that's incredible. Brilliant. Thank you once again, guys. Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you.
And good luck with everything. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye to Willie as well.
She's asleep. I'm going to go put her down before my arm falls off. Thanks,
bye.
Jim.
Tra.
Bye.
And so we bid farewell to another You're Not On The List with me, Jim Irvin, and my guests, Michelle Branch and Patrick Carney. Michelle chose Patti Griffin's Flaming Red, and Patrick chose the Feelies' Crazy Rhythms. And I pulled in Fleetwood Mac's Mystery To Me. You can hear all three albums on the Spotify playlist that accompanies the show. Just go along to Spotify and look for You're Not On The List, Season 2, Episode 3. And all three albums are in there with some of the other tunes that we've been talking about on this episode. And if you get a chance, do like or comment on the show wherever you get your podcasts, any platform, because that always helps drive new listeners towards us. And if you have any comments on the show, you can go along to jimirvin.com, where there is a page that you can email from there, or go to Anchor FM, the You're Not On The List website there, and there is facility to leave a voice message. And a couple of people asked about our theme music this month. It's called Butternut. It's by Theme Engine, and it's available at all good streaming services. Thanks very much for listening, and do join us again for more forgotten albums and the people who love them next time on You're Not On The List. Until then, goodbye.